Blog Talk Radio.
Welcome to CrimeWire, an elite team of veteran investigation experts, along with noted crime consultants and attorneys often featured on the popular news programs for families of violent crime to find answers and seek justice. The CrimeWire team, Vito Colucci Jr., private investigator and author, Denny Griffin, retired investigator and author, Susan Murphy Milano, violence expert and author, are there on top of the crime at the top of their game. CrimeWire is a place for information, news, safety, and most importantly, justice. Our interactive website is crimewiresite.com. You can call in any time during the show. The number is 1-646-478-0982. And remember, you can participate in tonight's show simply by going to the live interactive chat room right here on Blog Talk Radio. If you are a friend or a family member and you would like to send the CrimeWire team information on an unsolved or suspicious death, or you'd like to be considered for a segment on a case for a future show, please email us at thecrimewire@gmail.com.
Oh, good evening, everybody. Hi, how is everybody tonight?
Fine.
Good. Well, listen, remains have been identified as an Oklahoma boy who has been missing since 1994. Thomas Billy Lee Tillery had been missing from Marshall County since September 1994. The state medical examiner's office announced today that remains found in December 1994 have been identified as his. Now, this case is important because the medical examiner's officers sat on the remains 3 months after he was reported missing. So let's understand this. They find a piece of a skull. So whoever examined it thought it was a female skull. In that area, why didn't they look at the few kids in that area who were reported missing? This begs the question, how many remains across the country go unidentified? If you are a family member of a missing person, you need to go to www.nameus.gov. Let's talk a little bit about this case. Thomas Billy Lee Tillery was 11 years old when he went to a convenience store for a gallon of milk on September 19, 1994. His mother, Reba Tillery, told the Oklahoman newspaper in 1996. He was never seen alive again. Officials found part of a skull, some skin, and hair near Dixon, about 10 miles east of Ardmore, on December the 20th, 1994, but the remains went unidentified for more than 16 years. Medical examiner spokeswoman Cherokee Ballard said in a news release, the remains were identified as part of the Oklahoma Project Search for the Missing, an effort of the medical examiner's office, the Oklahoma State Bureau of Investigation, the University of North Texas Center for Human Identification, and local law enforcement agencies. Cause and manner of the boy's death were not able to be determined, Ballard said. A Carter County Sheriff's investigation into his disappearance and death is ongoing. No one was immediately available for comment at the sheriff's office. An anthropologist thought in 1995 that the skull belonged to a white child about 13 to 14 years old, but officials were unable to tell if it was a boy or a girl, Ballard said. It was reexamined in 2010 by the medical examiner's office with the help of the Carter County Sheriff's Office. And last but not least, a forensic artist completed a reconstruction of the skull, and the clay model resembled a photo of the boy used on a poster from the National Center for Missing and Exploited Children, Ballard said. A DNA profile from the skull was linked to the boy through a DNA profile of his mother, who now lives in California. Susan Murphy Milano, what's your take on this whole thing now?
Oh, shit. You know what? I'm pissed. I am pissed only because they don't, you know, there was no excuse for this. There weren't that, there were how many children missing from that area? It's not that big of a deal as far as the area where the boy was found. 3 months later, they find remains. They don't do anything with it. It sits there all these years. This is Oklahoma, as we know from, you know, going down there and working. The ME's office has been a travesty. What people don't realize is that right now, past the house, is the Shonda Turner bill, and Shonda Turner was murdered in Oklahoma. That's one of the cases of the Garvin County 3 that we profiled. I was down there at Ground Zero just a few months ago, along with Tom Horton and Sheila DeVinny. This is a joke. There was no reason for all these years to have passed without, you know, the family knowing that the remains have been found. I mean, Denny, I think you feel the same way.
It's really incredible, and it seems like the horror stories never end, and an awful lot of them from that Oklahoma area. We get stuff from all around the country, but that Oklahoma is just an amazing thing. It's really mind-boggling.
11-year-old boy.
And I understand why. Yeah, it's incredible.
11 years old. How many 11-year-olds in 1994 when he went missing? There's no excuse for this. And this is that medical examiner's office down there. This is poor police work. And it's not, you know, we're pro-police, so I'm not trying to kick anybody in there behind. But this goes to show you, and this is why this is so important with the Q Center coming up in this next case, because this is what they have to go do when cases aren't investigated. There is no excuse. You didn't need the internet. You didn't need certain tools back then just to go that extra mile. And here was a family racked with grief all these years.
And Susan, this boy would be a 28-year-old man now. He would probably have a bride, maybe have children, who were planning for his future. All that taken away. And, you know, it's taken away, but they couldn't even get a closure, you know, all these years.
There's no closure now. If you think about it, now that the remains have been recovered or they've identified just that skull, now think of who done it. Was there a serial killer out that way? I mean, that area out there in Oklahoma where this was found was not very far from where I was in Paul's Valley. And it is a wide open range. But it's places, like I said, with Monica and the case that she's bringing up from the Q Center, it's cases like that. I mean, she has to start from ground zero and put a piece of a puzzle together that sometimes the piece is just not looked at with fresh eyes. And I think that that's what's so important about what the Q Center does.
And not only that, Susan, you mentioned the word before, closure. Not too long ago, I had a top police official on one of my shows, and he says he hates that term because all that means is that the camera crews have gone home. It's not featured anymore on the news shows, not on television. But there's never, never any closure for the family. Maybe that's a small part of something when somebody gets arrested.
It's an acceptance of the event, of the tragedy that takes place. But for families of the missing and homicide victims, you never, ever have closure because those last minutes that you saw that person, that this little boy went to go get a gallon of milk, it's woulda, shoulda, coulda, those last words. And you're trying to hold on to things, and with every day, it just becomes more agonizing. So.
Well, Denny Griffith, you've seen so many of these cases over the years, and you know, sometimes we're on the show and we get some good results, but then we hear about things like this, you know, and I kid around sometimes because it always seems like you said it's Oklahoma, and Oklahoma, like my saying goes, Oklahoma is not okay. Denny, what can be done about this stuff? How do you change this, Denny?
Well, I think what's going on in Oklahoma now, and Susan alluded to it a few minutes ago, of trying to get the act cleaned up down there, because you can probably find in every state, you're going to find certain individuals, police officers or law enforcement type people, prosecutors, who maybe didn't do a very slam-bang job on some of their investigations. But the incredible number of cases from Oklahoma is really scary, and the people in the state are finally rising up and demanding some action, and that, I think, is what it takes to try to straighten these things out.
But I also think that, Denny, the cases of the missing, Just of the missing alone in general across the country, I think Oklahoma is a pimple on the elephant's ass as far as crime and missing persons cases go.
Yes. So
I think we should everybody's down. I think.
Pissed.
Yeah, it does. So I think that okay, everybody's down. I think we should.
Okay, tonight, Crime Wire consultant Monica Kason, founder of the Q Center for Missing Persons, brings us the case of Jamie Grissom. Now, keep in mind, listeners, that this case, we're going back 40 years. So if you hear some things that you say, well, why was such and such done or why was a certain procedure followed, keep in mind this case is 40 years old and it may have been handled a little differently back then than it would be today. Jamie was last seen on the morning of December 7th, 1971, as she left for school at Fort Vancouver High School by her sister. Her purse, ID, and possessions were found in May of 1972 in the woods northeast of Vancouver at a bridge crossing with very short distance from a trail where two other victims had been found. Jamie is considered to be the first victim of a potential serial killer who is believed to have raped and killed 6 to 8 young Vancouver women in Clark County between January 10, 72 and October 1st of 1974. This individual was tried for the deaths of one woman in 1978 and received a life sentence. Jamie is still missing. One body has never been identified to this day, but all victims except for Jamie have been found. Now, joining us tonight, along with Monica, to discuss the case is Star Lara. She is Jamie Grissom's sister. And welcome, ladies.
Thank you.
Hi, how are you?
All right, thank you very much. Thanks for being with us. Star, let me begin with you. When did someone first report your sister missing, and who reported her missing?
She was reported missing that night. Our caseworker reported her missing, and she went down to the police station and reported her. She actually signed something. It wasn't a missing persons report because they refused to let her file that for 30 days. That was the law back then. But she did sign a report, a police report. And so she was reported missing that night.
Do you recall what the investigation was like at that time? What did the police do once that report was filed? What happened?
The actual missing persons report or the initial one?
Well, the initial one, at what point did someone spring into action? I mean, a police agency spring into action to try to locate your sister?
Well, you know, I didn't find out what they did. Let's say I just didn't find out all that they did until about 10 years ago. So what I did find out at that time was that they had done a search out in the area where they found her belongings in May of 1972 at the point where they found her belongings. They took search dogs out there. They interviewed, you know, some people, her old foster father they interviewed, and they interviewed a foster cousin, and, you know, that's about all that I know that they did. You know, I've seen the police report, and it doesn't have a lot of record in there of what they did, so I only know what they told me.
Okay, and Monica, when did Q become involved with this case?
Q just became involved in the case within a couple months ago, and I want to go back real quick and let people understand the fact that these girls were in foster care, so that's, you know, and they were split up at some point as well, so that's why she doesn't know a lot as far as, like, when she was growing up and what happened until she became an adult and started, you know, trying to find out what happened to her sister at that point. But Q just, we were contacted just a few months ago, and basically what Star wanted from us was to help her gain media attention for the case so that this man wouldn't get out of jail. Because he's getting ready to get out of jail, we need to bring attention to that. But what I found in addition after we started speaking is that there's a larger issue here. There was an unidentified female found around the same time that these other ladies were found. She's never been identified, and she's been buried. And, you know, I strongly feel that unidentified female, in a large way, could be Jamie. So that's one of the main goals that we have in the next couple months is trying to see if we can't help get this girl identified, first off, to see if it is Jamie, and if it isn't, try to find out who she is, and then, you know, work towards continuing to get the story out there to keep this man from getting out of prison.
Yeah, because it's been my fear of what happened, you know, what happened with that little boy. That's been my fear for Jamie, that she has been found, never been identified, you know.
And hey, Star,
what steps have to be taken to try to get an identification? What do you have to go through?
Right now, all they have of this girl is her hair. And that's what the FBI, we've been waiting over a year now for them to see if they could extract anything from her hair. She was buried, you know, back in 1974. And that's all they kept.
Go ahead, Vito.
They've spent over a year on this issue, and it's really frustrating. They just need to go and exhume the girl and get true DNA.
Yeah, because whoever she is, her family has waited since 1974. I think that's long enough.
Yeah, that's definitely a good point, to exhume the body with all the technology nowadays with the DNA. But, Star, let me ask you this. In all these years, the police department, now we know, let's talk about this Warren Forrest. He's up for parole in April, okay? Mm-hmm. He was tried for the death of one woman in 1978 and received that life sentence. Has the police ever said to you at all, or anybody said to you, we know he's the one that killed her? Have they ever said that to you?
Oh, yeah, they flat out told me that.
Okay, so they've told you that, they're saying, but we don't have any evidence of that, right, or any proof?
Right, and they list him as a suspect in their crime synopsis, which is 6 pages long. They list Jamie first as his first victim.
Now, do you know?
Right.
And her belongings were found by the other bodies, Denny, too, just so you know. Her belongings, her personal items of Jamie were found out there near the other two girls' remains that were buried, that were recovered.
Hey, Monica, do you know the lady that was killed, the one that he was sentenced about, do you know if any of her family, by any chance, is going to go to this parole hearing and make a lot of noise? Has any of that come up?
I know Norma Countryman, which I believe is the one he's convicted on.
I don't understand why only, this doesn't seem right that only one, he was only convicted on one. I mean, they found more bodies.
They're saying six to eight.
And he worked there.
He worked there
when the bodies were found. That was his place of employment. I mean, everything, you know, it's definitely him.
See a picture of this guy, he was clean cut, he was married, he looked like, you know, Mr. Conservative, like nothing that we would think of somebody that's a serial killer would look like, right, Star?
He had no criminal record.
No, he didn't, and he worked for the park that they were found in, these bodies were found, and I do believe there's more bodies there, and if this Jane Doe, which is the third, is not identified, and it's not Jamie, then I think we need to go back up there, which is our next goal, is to get a historical cold case search and bring in some of the top dogs around the country that work, like old Indian burials and what have you, and try to find the rest of these bodies and or at least Jamie, because, you know, the chances of her being still up there, if this unidentified female is not her, are about 95%. Just because of the fact that they did find her personal belongings near the other two females that were located.
Yeah.
So if there's other bodies up there, do you keep in contact with the other families? I mean, that may have been gone missing during this time because of this guy. Is that something that you've been able to do?
No, I was never able to contact them. I didn't know how, but about 2 weeks ago, I got an email from a guy who is in contact with the one victim that survived, the one victim that survived in Washougal Park where the other girl was found dead. He's in contact with her, and then
which was amazing because of the fact that we had only had her new website up right in that person contacted her. So it definitely worked having a website for a cold case. That was one of the first things we did for her, was to get Jamie her own website up with current information.
Yeah,
and trying to get her case back out there.
Yeah, I haven't heard this stuff in 40 years. He contacted me, and the victim's brother contacted me, the surviving girl. Her brother contacted me through email, and this hasn't happened in 40 years. I never received any information from the victims or their friends. And so
the
I
website was really important.
Yeah, it's made a big difference. And, you know, I know that Norma Countryman's family is going to be there. That's all I know about that.
How old is this Warren Forrest now?
He is. Well, Jamie would be 55. He's like 5 years older, so he's 61.
61, yeah. Okay. So you don't know then. Go ahead.
Well, I mean, Monica, is this important that these families of these other victims kind of all come together now? Because of the website, because of what you're doing, does that help put together more of who could also be up there besides Jamie Grissom?
Well, absolutely, because a lot of times people just give up hope. You know, they just figure that their loved one will never be found, or they know the demise and they move on, but it's always lurking there for them. You know, like I said, when she came to us, immediately we needed to get her case current, and that's what we wanted to do. We wanted to get her on the social networks, which Star did. You know, get her own website where good information could be found just about this one person. And then start contacting media, which we've done. I think, I believe Nancy Grace called us a couple of days ago getting ready to do something with her story as well. So, I mean, we've got, you know, on the radio and trying to get her case out there. Nobody knows about her case.
There's a similar situation in Illinois. It's the Ripper murders, and they have allegedly killed 26 people. One woman survived. They've never even talked about the other bodies, and that's what reminds me of this case. Similar to this, and the case was from 81 to 84. There were all these murders. And Monica, families give up that easily on cases? Do they say no one's ever going to find anything? What do you say to the families that are listening right now?
I say there's always a chance to find something, and I say they're always, you should never give up hope if you want your loved one found. You know, there's always, if there's a will, there's a way. There are so many, like I said, nowadays there's so much technology and so many resources to help families with the missing, and that's really what's happening, Susan, is that, you know, cold cases are starting to come back alive because of the new technology and ways that people can reach out and educate themselves. So it's so important to have these cases out there and get that information out there and educate people about it. I mean, I didn't know anything about this man sitting in prison for killing these girls and that these bodies were found. I didn't know anything about her case. And when she first contacted me, I Googled it and had like 2 hits. Now you Google it, it's all over the Internet, and it's only been a few months. So, you know, we've got to get people educated. She needs help. She needs people to write into this parole board on the behalf of Jamie or any other victims that haven't been identified. You know, we need pressure, you know, on the law enforcement to get up there. It should not take over a year to mess around with some hair when you could go and exhume a body with $1,000 and just get some good DNA and let this family know that it is either Jamie or it is not.
Denny, is this something that CrimeWire could maybe put up there and make a plea for? Is this something that we're able to do, perhaps?
I would think we could, yes.
Okay, maybe Kim can, you know, we can put up the information and whatever, we can get Star's information.
If this man gets out, another girl will die. Somebody will die. We've got to stop it.
For sure. Yeah, for sure.
Go ahead.
Yeah, I was just curious. I'm getting back to to the Mr. Forrest here. If I understood properly, accurately, the bodies were all found about where this guy worked and so forth. Obviously, there was enough to get him a conviction on the one homicide. It almost seems that there should have been some way to tie them all together. I'm surprised, as Vito mentioned a few minutes ago, that he was only convicted on the one charge, even though apparently it's one of these things, he's the guy, but it can't be proved. Does anybody know, Monica or Star, to hear where the evidence fell apart or where it was lacking to charge him in the other cases and why it was only one that they could do?
What he did get convicted on was the murder that occurred in the same park where the surviving victim was. And I think he actually had a mistrial the first time on that case. I think they were afraid to lose their only opportunity on the other cases because they didn't have a witness at the other parks, you know, that had survived.
Go ahead, Vito. So they felt the bird in the hand was worth two in the bush.
Yeah. And I think maybe they hoped he'd just die in prison or something, you know?
Yeah, that's a good point, Denny. The 70s and 80s were my era as a cop. And that was the mindset back then. See, like she said, you mentioned bird in the hand. She said, well, hopefully he'll die in jail. Well, obviously not, because he's up for parole now. So the mindset back then was, okay, we got him nailed on this. He ain't never going to get out probably anyway. Let's get him on this and not take any chances, which is a terrible mindset now when you look at it, because this man may get out, and he's been in jail. He's in his 60s now. What has he got to do? He's not going to get a job. All these things that have been stored up in him for many, many years are probably going to rear its ugly head again, and that's the problem we have over here.
Exactly.
Does that happen a lot, Vito?
Well,
in the country?
You got to remember that era. No forensics, no DNA, no nothing back then. All right, we got this guy. We caught him. Here's the surviving victim. Let's go. He'll probably get 40 or 50 to life, which means he'll never get out. He'll be 80 or 90 or something like that. Unfortunately, this one didn't work out that way, okay? And it's kind of tough now after 40 years, 41 years, whatever it is, to go back and try to solve these other ones. But I agree with Monica. They got to dig up the skeleton, and they got to try to do some DNA on it and try to nail this now, especially if they can put their hands on it right now. That's a good point.
Well, and it could be Jamie. That's my whole point. This woman is still sitting here searching for her sister, and her sister could be sitting right there.
Whoever it may be. I mean, it'll probably wind up being Jamie, but even if not, you're going to at least solve one of these other ones for a family.
Absolutely.
Yeah. Totally.
And that's, I just don't understand why, you know, it's bad enough that the case is this old, okay? But to have this hot new information that you can actually do something to change the course and bring some kind of resolution, because I, too, agree with the police officer. I hate the word closure, because I don't believe there's closure to anything in life. I believe there's resolution to each situation. But bring resolution to this girl's identity, and if it is Jamie, then, you know, let's move on from there, and where do they go next? Now they've got new information into an old investigation, and maybe they can rearrest him or build some kind of DNA. I mean, I don't know the answers to all that, but I do know that this girl has to be identified, and I know before June, we're going up there to Washington, and if someone don't dig her up, I will.
Monica, does the FBI indicate, you said it's been about a year, they've been monkeying around, or not monkeying around, but they've had this hair thing. Did they give you any idea when they're going to have a completion of it, or is it just in limbo?
Sorry, go ahead and answer that, because you've talked to them.
It's spent like 6 months with the Washington State Police Crime Lab, and they couldn't extract DNA from it, so they sent it to the FBI. So for the last 6 months, it's been at the FBI. You know, and it's probably not top on their priority list, so.
Well, you would think, though, I mean, this is a serial killing of a lot. one is one too many, but you're talking about a handful of women.
I know.
You would think that they would want to sell this stuff.
Not even women, children.
Yeah, they were children. Yeah, 14.
They were children.
Yeah, they really weren't women, you know.
I didn't see the age of all the victims. Yeah.
Susan, now, a lot of times we hear, you know, it's not on the person's list, it's not on their list, it may take months, it may take whatever. But we need to understand, and they need to understand, that, again, in 50 days, this man is up for parole. So that should put this a little bit more closer to the top, just for that reason alone, you know?
Well, I think we can hit it. You know, I've done some stuff in the past. I think we can come up with a few things. Like I said, if Kim Colton, our director of research, and she's very good at this, if she can go ahead and put some things together, and we can put it on the forum and we can put them on the CrimeWire site, and we can also take it on our sites and put it up, because it does travel. It does make changes. And it the Internet, I don't think people realize the importance of just what the Internet can do besides spreading the information and getting these cases from cold to hot. In some cases, the Internet is what's solving these cases, because we've seen, I can't remember the guy's name, I want to say it was in Texas, it was a 38-year-old case. He happened to be a former cop. And the guy that he killed was in the military, and they solved it by somebody coming through and seeing something on the Internet. The Internet is the world of where people are going, because we don't have newspapers anymore. We're not some little community world. We don't all sit around at 6 o'clock and watch, you know, the local news and then the national news. The Internet is our national platform for change, and it crawls. And I think that is what's going to do it for this as well. I think that if we put some pressure on it, I can also send some letters to the parole board and Star, you're going to have to do that, and whomever else you can get up there. Maybe where she went to school. Are you still in the same area?
Yeah, I am. And
okay.
I do have reporters going with me to the hearing.
Maybe go to reunion.com. And go and see where you and she went to school, and ask for a shout out. Ask for them to help you and send letters and give them the address of where they can do this, because this was their classmate.
That's a good idea. I have a notice on there about Jamie and asking for information, but I had never thought about going on there recently about this.
Okay, that's what I want you to do, and then take all the churches in the area within a 50-mile radius of where she went missing, and write to the pastor, get their addresses off the Internet, and say we need the church members to also send letters and put this on sites and blogs. Again, she was a community member. They may not remember her, but I'm sure that it was always whatever happened to Jamie. And they can do something about Jamie. So maybe that from this point forward, we call this, you know, it's Jamie Grisham's campaign for justice. And everybody can do their little bit of part by emailing a letter or sending a letter or a postcard or a fax, if that makes sense.
I mean, it's vital to give this case support. And this is what, you know, people say, oh, what can you do with a cold case? But there's actually more you can do with a cold case nowadays, because the first thing you do when you pick it up is find out there's so much that hasn't been done and needs to be done. And this is one of those cases. There is so much we can do right now to identify this girl, to help support this family, keep this man from getting out of prison, heat up the investigation, bring forth new information. So there is so much that needs to be done, and it doesn't need to continue to wait months on end. It just doesn't take that long. I'm sorry. It just doesn't.
No. And Denny, you know, if this guy got out, what would happen? We would see a range of other things, and it would be a while before we'd learn about that, wouldn't we?
Yeah.
Oh, it would be. I was just thinking about that while you were talking, and it's scary. And, you know, Zavito commented a bit ago that, you know, the mindset 30 or 40 years ago, they were saying, well, this guy's going to get life. We got him on this one. Let's take it and move on. And I remember I used to get annoyed sometimes back in New York. I'd get annoyed with people because at the time, I don't know what it is now, but at the time, a second-degree murder conviction could be a 20-to-life sentence. Okay, you had a low end of 20 to life. But that meant that once they served the 20, they'd be eligible for parole. And a lot of the public didn't look at the low end of the sentence. When they had to see was that life, or hear life, as part of the sentence. And like leaders, they say, this guy's going to die in jail. He's never going to breathe free air again. I used to say, wait a minute. You got this guy. He's 22 years old. He can be out when he's 40, mid-40s. You know, we got to think about that. But it's frustrating.
And, Denny, another point at a parole hearing, and our listeners need to understand this, when they ask him questions, this fella, and all he has to do, not that all he has to do, one of the things he has to do is apologize and say he's rehabilitated, obviously, and admit to that crime. He has to admit to that crime. But the problem is he only has to admit to that one crime, okay?
Yeah.
He can't admit to Jamie's or any of the other ones. So that's the whole problem with that. He has to say, yeah, okay, sure, I did it. I did my 30-something years. I'm rehabilitated. Now I want to get out of here. So people need to understand he's not going to, at a parole hearing, he's not going to talk at all, or neither can they ask him at all about any of the other crimes.
But community pressure on the parole hearing will do wonders for him not even being considered and him not being able to tell his story.
Very good, Susan. That's why I asked the question a half hour ago about any family of that first victim when he was sentenced on. They need to flood that courthouse, cousins, whatever, friends, anybody that will
again,
go there.
Again, you go back to the kids that didn't graduate with her when she died or that did. You go back to those people now that are 55 that have grandchildren of their own. They always wonder and think about that person. You never – there was somebody actually on it was Gacy, somebody that I went to school with, Greg Gotzik, 1976. He goes missing. Somebody gets a hold of me today on Facebook, and he is now, as of, I guess, a week or two ago, clean and sober. But when this kid went missing, he was tagged in one of the numbers in the garage, because when John Wayne Gacy's crime scene, and I grew up a mile from there in Chicago, when John Wayne Gacy's crime scene, before they demolished the house, they were still excavating inside the garage and in the basement, in the sub-basement, and all it was numbers. And there were so many victims that so I remember all of us standing in front of the garage going, which number is John? And he had this goofy car. I don't remember what year it was, but it was his pride and joy. And John Wayne Gacy was a contractor. And you know, these boys started going missing. And here was this kid, because he got kicked out of class with me. Here was this kid. I'm not going to say his name, but he goes, my friend's missing, and nobody's paying attention to this contractor. Nobody. And I was afraid to say something to him. I communicated with him on today, actually, about Facebook. I didn't say the guy's name, and he said, I don't know if you remember, but I was best friends with Greg Gotzik, and I said I didn't want to open up a wound, but okay. And he said, the horror of that. He's a schoolmate. The horror of that, of what happened, of the thought of it, just pierced him. It never left him. So can you imagine the people that knew Jamie and these other victims?
Because I went to a class reunion this summer, and I had a classmate tell me that she never got over Jamie's disappearance and what happened. She said she was very traumatized by it. And I, all these years, I never knew that, you know. I never heard from classmates because I kind of left town, you know. After I got to be 18, and I wouldn't go back. I would not go back to Vancouver for years and years and years.
And I didn't think about Greg Gotzik until I saw something through somebody. I had gone back. I was at a gathering of kids I went to school with, and somebody said something. I wound up writing about him. Because I was like, how dare me? I'm doing this work. I said, how dare I forget about him? And I wanted, you know, because it was so piercing to all of us to stand out in the cold and watch this across the street. And like I said, this kid, all these years later, probably the same age, and is so torn that he says something, but I'm afraid to say something to him first, and that he carried this with him, and that his life was. It's not an excuse, but they were very tight, and I dated one of the guys from the group, so that's how I knew everybody, and you just never know.
And the ripple effect, you know. I think about the one 18-year-old girl that was killed that had two little twin girls, you know, and how they grew up without their mother, and I'm pretty sure that That's not the one that he got convicted on. So, they, you know, they've gone all those years without justice. And yeah, it's just, I believe those people are going to get a special kind of hell for all the
I don't think there is. I hope there's no. I always think of people like that as chained to a movie screen over and over, and there's it's really hot, and all
yeah.
they're watching is over and over what their life. You know, that's how you think of. I mean, that's how I've always thought of people. In that way, because I couldn't think of them any other way. I don't know that, you know, people say, and the worst thing anybody, and if you're listening, and I talk to a lot of victims and things and throughout the day, the worst thing you can say to a victim is, God only gives you what you can take. I'm here
that
to tell
is,
you that's bullshit.
God
it's,
does not
it's crap.
That. That is
because,
oh, that just makes me angry. God doesn't give
it makes,
that.
Yeah.
Fuller gave us
no.
that kind of help. Yeah,
that, and Monica, you know,
he directs
Monica,
our hearts. He tries to direct our hearts, but it's like a parent with a child. You can't control
yeah.
a child once they become an
no.
adult. And it's the same with God.
No.
He can't control us by the nature of who we are. You know, we have to control our actions. And I
we do, and I think, Monica, you can speak to this, how important it is for the public to understand to support a missing person's family or a homicide victim's family, but to not add salt on the wound, because we don't know how to talk to them sometimes. To say
yeah, that is
to me, those are,
because
Monica, that's the first thing people do, don't they, sometimes?
Well,
yeah.
Most of the time, their closest neighbors and friends and even sometimes family members get to a point and they kind of shy away and turn away from the family or the person that's suffering the most from the disappearance and the unknown fate of that missing loved one. And then they get to a point because they don't want to feel bad and continue to feel bad and don't know what to say to the person. So what they do is they start pulling back, which is the worst thing that they can do. Or they
yeah.
do make, you know, statements like, you know, well, let's just pray, you know, for, you know, kind of let's sit back and pray and let's move on with our life, or very hurtful things, expecting you to just, like, replace that person or just move past that void, and it just doesn't happen. You know, you can't tell a mother of a missing child or a sister of a missing sister or whatever, you can't just tell them, well, you know, it's been a long time, let's just get over it and, you know, pat them on the shoulder and expect them to move on. You know, people are born into our lives, people become a part of our lives and we love them, and there's a reason that they become so important in our life. When that person is ripped from that part of our life, there is that hole, that void, that thing that that person gave us that became a part of our life to begin with. You cannot just replace it with time, and you cannot replace it with just, you know, a few words, or let's try to move forward, or let's stay busy, or let's go play baseball, or whatever it is. I mean, it just doesn't happen. So, you know, be there for the families. Step up and ask them, do you want to talk about it? Respect them if they don't want to talk about it, and help them make good choices and remain positive and find ways to be positive. That's all you can do.
And don't be degrading and say, are you still looking for this person? Are you still doing this?
Oh, I know.
That is
and the one that I hate is, like, they say, well, is there anything new? Well,
you just
want to
strangle them.
I would have given up a long time ago. Like, you know, I'm in it for the long haul because, you know, I have to find her.
Hey,
and
Monica,
then I believe that will
so
happen. I do believe that will happen.
I do, too. I just...
Go ahead, Vito.
Monica, just a question for you that I'm sure our listeners would want to know, since you're the founder of the Q Center for Missing Persons. When people contact you, what is your criteria for taking the case? And I mean, what do you look at on the case? And how many do you get, actually, that come across your desk?
Oh, good Lord. Well, I've got 19 this month. So, you know, every month varies. Some days we can get 5 or 6 on a Monday, and sometimes we get, you know, 5 or 6 in a week. But they definitely are steady coming in. We get a lot of cold cases because of people finding out about us. But we really don't have a criteria as far as accepting a case. We accept every case. We have a criteria of getting a case properly registered. And meaning registered, there's a list of items that we request in order to take your case that's on our website and that we explain to families as well. And once we get that important information that we need, which is a part of our protocol, then we sit down and we review the case. And we find out what else we need to, you know, better information. And usually if I sit down and read a case, I can come up with 20 questions right away. In other words, as I'm reading, I'm writing questions on the side of why is it this answer, or what's the last name to this person, or why is this date, you know, times wrong on the report, or whatever, and why wasn't this done? And then I have a list of questions for law enforcement, but I'll additionally have a list of questions for families. So then we immediately start making phone contact with different people, and we start building that information and trying to get solid dates, times, and facts. And then we make an assessment. Okay, what is the family requesting, but also what can best fit this case? You know, when Star called us about Jamie's case, she was just wanting us to help her with media, and then she told me the story, and I'm like, but there's so much more that needs to be done that she was just asking for the little bit of help because she didn't know where to start. So now we have a huge goal plan, and I do believe this case will get solved. It's just dormant. It's sitting on a shelf. It's been aged so long, and people are taking their time, and we can't tolerate that. You know, if there's a chance to solve a 40-year-old case, a 30- or 10-year-old case, let's hurry up and do it.
I do notice things that I don't think the police thought about,
like what?
Yeah, well, today has changed so much.
Like the location of all the bodies, did they ever map it out? I mean, when I read Jamie's report, it didn't seem like they did that much, you know.
Doesn't that go to the time of the crime, the era?
Yeah.
You know, the year, what was 1971, is a different time. It was not, you know, 40 years, crime has changed. How we look at the cases, how we report them, how they're investigated, the accountability or lack thereof is very different. Back then it was just kind of guys like Denny and Vito going out in their flat shoes and you know, saying how you doing and investigating the case. And being persistent about it, but I mean,
That's no excuse, because that's why we have cold case teams, and our tax dollars are paying these people to go back and review cases. So
But they didn't have cold case units back then, did they?
No, but they got them now. Why are
they got them now? That's right. But I think that there's also, and it's no excuse, but the backup. I think that they're overwhelmed by all of this. I mean, I don't think that anybody expect. It's almost like all of a sudden there's this avalanche of things because they weren't done properly or couldn't be done, or because they were doing other things and didn't look at these cases right away, possibly as a missing person or a serial killing, and that's why you've got this backlash, this avalanche now of these cases.
They did know in 19... When did they do that crime synopsis? 1978 or something. They knew they had a serial killer on their hands. They did know that.
Was it publicized?
As far as in the media, I don't know. But they definitely knew he was a serial killer. They made note of it in the police files. They just couldn't prove it, you know, but they knew. In fact, they basically said he was the first serial killer of Clark County.
Denny, does that make sense to you when in a small area like that they would try to keep it quiet?
Well, I can only think of that if it was some financial thing, like a tourist area where they didn't want bad publicity or something like that. Mm-hmm. But I would think if the citizenry found out that there was this potential serial killer on the loose in their community, and the word wasn't being put out, they weren't being warned, they weren't being told, there'd be some very upset people, and probably rightfully so. So unless there was some underlying reason not to put it out there, I would think that the small areas would be going full tilt.
Once they found out what they had, I think he was already in a mental hospital, and then maybe that was part of it. They just didn't want to bring it up because he was already, you know, locked up. I don't know.
And Susan?
Well, you know,
Susan? Yeah, now,
yeah.
You know, we're talking about the whole serial killer thing here. What happens in a smaller area, Denny brought up a good point about not a lot of the mindset back then was let's not scare the public. But on another matter, see, the Son of Sam in New York, that was 1977, okay? So you're dealing with a major city. You had the New York News, the New York Post. They made it where that was what anybody talked about from morning to night, okay? That became a big – and that was before any cable, any news channels or things of that nature. So it really depends on how far the public, the news, the press would want to go.
In Chicago, when John Wayne Gacy was doing these things, nobody heard about it. All these kids were being just abducted. Like I said, it was from my neighborhood, and it wasn't talked about. Nobody knew about it, and the only reason that they caught the guy was because some former Vietnam vet had stumbled upon his house to ask for donations or do something for the Fraternal Order Police, and he smelled death in the house. And he went back to the station and said, something's wrong over here. That's how they found John Wayne Gacy, X amount of bodies later. And they didn't put it together, and these were all from one area. Nobody talked to the other, and they wanted to keep it quiet. They didn't want to scare anybody. They didn't know what they had in their hands. That there's no excuse for that. That's in Chicago. And Son of Sam, yeah, but this too. I mean, I just think that when they keep quiet about it, when departments don't get together annually or semi-annually and they don't talk about these cases, that it hurts the public, it hurts future lives of families because they're not talking. And I think that's look at this case, Jamie Grissom. Look at all of these other people.
Their computers weren't connected then. I mean, they didn't even have computers then, but...
Yeah, but they all got together and did hand-to-mouth combat at the bar and after shifts and stuff. I mean, they could have also done something. Again, and I'm not trying to be – I know people sometimes think that I might be a little bashing, but I'm not. I'm just pointing out facts. That there could have been more to do with these kind of cases and putting them together. I think that you know, I know the police can only do so much, but it's an excuse when they just blatantly – you know, don't come together as a team in counties, in certain areas, and just say, even back then, this is what we're going to do. You know, so.
Yeah, I am grateful for the police they have there now, though. I really am, because they are very receptive to me, you know.
Why don't you give us your website, because we're about out of time. So give us.
It's helpfindjamiegrissom.com. Find Jamie, not help find, it's findjamiegrissom.com. That's really important.
And then
there
for
it's findjamiegrissom.com.
So if anybody has any information, please call the Q Center for Missing Persons. The number is 910-343-1131. There's a 24-hour tip line, which is very important. 910-232-1687. And I'm asking everybody that's listening to the show on the rebroadcast to please email us at thecrimewire@gmail.com. Tell us what you will do to help to get this information out there for us. If you can put it in your area, if you're out in that area in Washington or Portland, Oregon, or Spokane, so that we can get the information out. Tell us that you will go ahead and take the information that we put together and get it on the websites. The more you pass it around, the more that there's a probability of solving these cases. Monica Quezon, thank you so much, and Star Lara, thank you so much for being on here. We'll keep everybody updated.
Thank you so much.
Okay. I think, Denny and Vito, we need to talk. We have a couple of minutes. We have a special on Sunday night.
Yay!
February 27th.
Yay!
Yay is right.
why don't you explain, Denny, what it is?
Okay. CrimeWire... We started, our first show was June of 2010, so we got about 10 months under our belt now. And we decided to do a little more, I call it taking to the next level, in the way of trying to help move these cold and unsolved and suspicious death cases along toward solution or resolution, if you will. And we've added a new team member to give us a hand with this, and we're establishing an actual a crime wire investigator bureau, and we're going
to... We have a surprise announcement. We can't say it now. Don't say what it is, but we have a huge, huge announcement on Sunday night. Huge.
Yes. And I think people will be very interested in hearing what we have to say. And I think it's a giant step forward. And I, Susan or Vito, you can correct me if I'm wrong, I'm not aware of anyone else doing what we're going to do.
No. Vito, no, I don't think so.
No. No, not at all. Not at all.
No. No. And I think we've, you know, even me, I mean, I think that we can all say we have learned a lot from all these families. And, you know, I know that in a lot of ways we need more help on the cases. And just like, you know, this Jamie Grissom's case is a perfect example. You know, all the cases that we have been able to highlight, and we want to be able to do more. And it's, you know, it's important to me, and I've always wanted to ask you, because you're both on the air, we can do this. I know, you know, you've learned a lot from me, both of you, as far as just victims, a different perspective.
That's right.
I think that as a homicide survivor, and I don't always wear it, but sometimes you can tell when I get jumping up and down and get upset about a case, or because I do, we all take them personally, but I think that part of this is because we've created a solid relationship between the three of us, and I think that also you're tired of me calling you and saying, what are we doing about this one after we do a show. I'm kidding, kind of, but I'm kind of not, just because this is a dream of all of ours together, and I couldn't ask for two better people, now three better people, to be associated to do this, because the amount of cases that we get in the door is horrific. And I don't, you know, I want to be able to, as we all decided that as a team we could be so effective then, as far as really helping the families in such a way with an affiliation that we're going to announce on the 27th. And that's our bottom goal, our bottom line, because while the Q Center goes and finds the missing remains, the families continue for justice doesn't just stop there. You know, she brings them home, and we try to bring them justice. So that was why this was so important, wasn't it?
Very important.
Yeah, you're right.
Everybody better tune in Sunday night to hear this.
They should.
Absolutely.
And we even have a telephone number for people to call and tips.
Yes.
And it's like I said, it's important. Go ahead, Dan.
Yeah, getting back a little bit to the Q case of the month that we did tonight. It's really so important, and I realized that when I was listening to that case and this guy, this suspect, convicted of one murder and a suspect and the rest of them, coming up for parole, it's so important to involve people. Like Vito said, that parole hearing building or room should be filled to the rafters. I mean, there should be standing room only and a line outside or whatever of people letting the authorities know that what their feelings are. And that can influence how these people decide. If nobody gives a damn, or it appears that nobody gives a damn except maybe the sister of the victim or something, that's probably not going to get the job done, or not as efficiently as having that place filled with people who are fired up and want to see justice and don't want this guy turned loose on the streets. And it's just so important that kind of stuff be done and that people get involved.
And I think that's what we're asking people to do on the special that we're going to have on the 27th, and with this new crime bureau, that we put a lot of work into these shows every week. And we just don't come on the air and give it lip service. We hope that in order to have successful outcomes in these cases, that people join with us. Vito, you want to say anything? You're awful quiet.
No, just listening. I'm excited about that. Sunday night, everybody will hear everything. I think right now we got about, 30 seconds to take this out, right?
Okay, so we want to thank our Crime Wire team, Director of Research, Kim Colton, and Public Relations team of ImaginePublicity.com. Our show is Sunday night, February 27th from 9 to 10. And mark your calendars, tune in as we analyze, dissect the cases that interrupt and wreak havoc on families looking for answers seeking justice. Vito.
Our next, you're not saying about our next show?
No, go ahead.
Okay,
I did.
All right.
We're on Sunday.
Okay, all right. You were going to talk about Eric Cross. That's okay. Thank you for joining us tonight on Crime Wire. We always welcome your support and value you as our guest. If you would like your case to be featured on Crime Wire, email us at thecrimewire@gmail.com. Or to hear a rebroadcast of tonight's show, go to www.crimewireblogspot.com. Turn on the volume at your computer, make some popcorn, get some Dr. Pepper, and the show will automatically play.
And remember, we ensure that your voices will be heard. When there's nowhere else to turn, visit our website at www.crimewiresite.com. God bless from the Crime Wire team, Vito Colucci Jr., Denny Griffin, and Susan Murphy Milano. Thank you very much for joining us, and please come back with us Sunday, and have a great night.
Thanks. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.